It is Thursday, October 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry prepares to hold talks in Vienna with Russian Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov about the civil war in Syria.
I mean, for Putin, it puts him again at diplomatic center stage. He's painted this picture that all roads lead to Russia.
Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton faces a congressional panel on the 2012 terrorist attack on Americans in Benghazi, Libya. And we look at the new film, Rock the Casbah. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry holds bilateral and multilateral talks Friday in Vienna with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov about a political solution to the nearly five-year civil war in Syria. Comments by John Kirby, a U.S. State Department spokesman, Wednesday followed an extraordinary one-day trip to Moscow by President Bashar al-Assad and a meeting with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin.
The focus of the meeting with Foreign Minister Lavrov, bilaterally and then multilaterally, obviously is towards getting at a political transition in Syria. How long would it take and how would it be implemented? There's still a lot of spade work to do, and I don't think that these meetings this week are going to be anywhere near the end of those kinds of discussions. Now, Moscow and Damascus have a relationship, have had one. Obviously now, Russian military aircraft and military forces are increasing their support in tangible ways to the Assad regime. That they continue to do that remains just as much an issue of concern for us as it was before his visit to Moscow. And I think you can expect that Secretary Kerry will once again reiterate our deep concern about the continued military support for the Assad regime, because in our view, there's not going to be a military solution to the civil war, and that any attempt to find one, certainly one that props up Assad, is only going to prolong it and make the threat of extremism deeper in Syria. So there's no surprise here that Putin and Assad would meet and discuss, given the history that they have.
John Kirby says the task of finding a political solution in Syria is made more difficult if Mr. Assad is emboldened by the support he receives from the Russian military, which intervened on September 30th with airstrikes it says are aimed at terrorists. Nabil Khoury, a Middle East analyst at Chicago's Northwestern University, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty there's little doubt that Russia's intervention has breathed new life into the Damascus government's struggle with the Syrian opposition.
The Syrian army is regaining territory lost earlier to opposition forces, and Iran and the Lebanese Hezbollah have stepped up their support on the ground. So clearly, in the last few weeks, Assad has felt good about what's happening on the ground. I think this visit is not so much to further embolden him as to showcase that Russia has the upper hand in terms of determining how things are going in Syria, and perhaps broader than that in the region.
Is this a hopeful sign, or is this a failure of U.S. foreign policy?
You could view it both ways. It is a failure of U.S. policy, because for the past four, almost 5 years, the initiative was there for the U.S. to take. And the types of initiatives that this administration has taken have fallen far short of accomplishing anything, whether militarily on the ground or politically. The Russians stepped in and militarily already are making a difference, and this was the goal of their military intervention, not so much to just have some token strikes against people they don't like, but to actually reverse the strategic situation on the ground. It was a very purposeful military intervention, and it clearly has made a difference. Now comes the time for some kind of a political move, and clearly from the Some of the videos that came out of the meeting showed essentially Putin lecturing at Assad and telling him that with the military achievements now going on, the time for a political settlement is approaching.
Nabil Khoury of Northwestern University. Another regional observer, Trinity University's David Lesh in Texas, tells Victor Beatty Tuesday's Assad-Putin meeting in Moscow was a diplomatic coup for both leaders.
I mean, for Putin, it puts him again at diplomatic center stage. He's painted this picture that all roads lead to Russia. I mean, look at who he's received in Russia over the last month and a half or so. Leaders or leading officials from Turkey, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Iran. He's long met with elements of the Syrian opposition, and now Assad. So the image, you know, that he gives is that only he can meet with all of the stakeholders in the conflict from all sides of the conflict, and that only he can generate an end to the conflict. And for Assad, of course, we know he's been an international pariah. He's been delegitimized as a ruler by most. But now, you know, he's just met quite possibly at the current time with the most popular, influential leader in the world. And just through osmosis, you know, he gains some legitimacy, and he presents this image of being statesmanlike, in control, that he's on the uptick, that he's breaking out of his isolation. And I think this is important to his supporters, you know, to buoy them that, you know, he is indeed, you know, returning to the fold, so to speak. And also keeping those in Syria that don't necessarily like Assad, but see him as the lesser of all evils, keeping them on board and not joining the opposition.
What about the opposition? Where does this leave them?
You know, I think that from Putin's perspective, I mean, the way that they have carried out their military strikes, they have degraded the non-ISIS opposition. And frankly, I think that Putin and Russia have engaged in this because they've made the conclusion that a negotiated solution or a political settlement is out of the question. It just isn't going to happen. They tried, and therefore, let's try a different tactic. And this one is to degrade the non-ISIS opposition to the point where all that's left in the short or near term is, if Putin achieves his objectives, is Assad versus ISIS. And he's betting on most of the world saying in that sort of situation that they'll side with the lesser of evils and they'll side with Assad. I think he's underestimating the fighting ability of the non-ISIS opposition in Syria. And also, I think he's probably reinvigorated some of the Sunni Arab conservative monarchies in the Persian Gulf in particular, individuals and governments, to increase their support for Sunni elements in Syria to fight against Assad. So I think Putin may have underestimated that. But if he's successful, it obviously at a fairly low level cost will have achieved some immediate term objectives.
David Lesh, however, cautions that Russia's policy is fraught with risk. Elements of the Syrian opposition, including Chechen jihadists, he says, want to attack Russians. He believes it's only a matter of time until Russians are killed and wonders how Mr. Putin will react. Well, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton testifies before a special congressional committee today probing the 2012 terrorist attacks that killed four Americans in Benghazi, Libya. Clinton was Secretary of State at the time, and her testimony could have an impact on her White House hopes. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a preview from Washington.
Republicans are expected to grill former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about the terror attacks that took four American lives, including U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Chris Stevens. But Clinton has seized on Republican comments the Benghazi committee is targeting her politically.
Everybody thought Hillary Clinton was unbeatable, right? But we put together a Benghazi special committee. What are her numbers today?
Clinton went on the attack during the recent Democratic presidential debate.
This committee is basically an arm of the Republican National Committee. It is a partisan vehicle, as admitted by the House Republican Majority Leader, Mr. McCarthy, to drive down my poll numbers. Big surprise. And that's what they have attempted to do.
Chairman Trey Gowdy acknowledges his committee is under scrutiny.
I have told my own Republican colleagues and friends, shut up talking about things that you don't know anything about.
House Speaker John Boehner says the probe is about finding the truth, not politics.
Benghazi's committee is about what happened before, during, and after a terrorist attack in Libya. where four Americans died. The American people deserve the truth about what happened, period.
Clinton opponents are also running ads.
I'd like to ask you why you ignored calls for help in Benghazi.
Clinton has been in this position before, fending off Senate Republicans at a 2013 hearing.
The fact is, we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make?
The political stakes for Clinton are huge, says Republican strategist Ford O'Connell.
I think the optics of it could really be damaging to Hillary Clinton, regardless of what comes out of that hearing.
But Clinton remains formidable, says analyst John Fortier.
I think it's hard for Hillary Clinton to change the big perception of her. She's very well known, but that has its pluses and minuses. She's going to have strong negatives. She's had them for a long time. There are plenty of people who know her and don't like her, but she's also got strong supporters.
Clinton got high marks for her recent debate performance and continues to lead her main challenger, Bernie Sanders, in national polls. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for reaction from social media. As we heard, former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is preparing to testify about the terrorist attack that killed four Americans in Benghazi, Libya. The New York Times reports that Clinton has been getting ready for the hearing at her home in Washington. The newspaper says the hearing in many ways will amount to a test of patience and will. To succeed politically, she must remain calm, take every question seriously, and avoid outbursts during what is expected to be a day-long appearance. USA Today reports the proceeding bursts into public view with a highly anticipated interview of Clinton, who was Secretary of State at the time, and further speculates that the interview promises to be a combination of hard-nosed investigation into Clinton's management of the agency and political drama that could shape the 2016 campaign for the White House. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Anyone who has done a head count at a large gathering knows how frustrating and monotonous this task can be. Now imagine you're working for a large corporation or government agency and you need to determine how many people participated in an event that attracted thousands of people. The long and boring process usually involves people who examine aerial photos of the crowd. The photos may be overlaid with a grid of cells a couple of centimeters square. Then, one cell at a time, the counters tally the number of heads per cell. Researchers at the University of Central Florida have now come up with an automated crowd counter. The software they created allows a computer to scan aerial photographs and then count the number of people in the images automatically. The software creators say that what had taken a week to complete can be done in as little as 30 minutes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about the new film, Rock the Casbah. Pakistani and U.S. officials believe that Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's meeting with President Barack Obama at the White House today will offer an opportunity to advance the goal of deepening bilateral ties. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's talks with President Obama come at a time of increased security and economic cooperation between Pakistan and the United States. The two leaders last met at the Oval Office in October of 2013. Pakistani officials say they are seeking to establish an enduring partnership with the United States, which is not limited to counterterrorism and security cooperation only, as has been the case historically. Masood Khan, the head of Islamabad's state-run Institute of Strategic Studies, says Thursday's meeting at the White House will help further the relationship.
I think by and large, in the past 2 years, the relationship between the two countries has been on the right track and it has been making steady progress. Understanding between the leadership has deepened.
Pakistan counter-militancy operations and its efforts to promote peace and bring an end to the conflict in Afghanistan are expected to figure prominently in the discussions between President Obama and Sharif. Tariq Fatemi, a key foreign policy advisor of the Pakistani Prime Minister, told local media before heading for Washington that Pakistan is ready to facilitate another round of peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. And if the Afghan government believes that this process is not in their favor, he says, then whatever other options they want to exercise, they are welcome to exercise it as a sovereign and independent nation. Fatemi reiterated that Pakistan, as a friendly neighbor with multiple linkages, is ready to play any role that can help promote peace process in Afghanistan. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and other officials in Kabul, however, are skeptical about Pakistan's intentions and want the neighboring country to cut support to the Taliban to prove its sincerity. They also blame Islamabad for the uptick in militant attacks in Afghanistan. Analyst Khan says Prime Minister Sharif's talks with President Obama could still help revive the Afghan peace process.
I think there's a possibility that the United States would use its clout vis-a-vis the Afghan government to persuade them to come to the negotiating table. So let's remain optimistic about it. Yes, the Kabul government has taken a stance, and that's not very helpful. But I think there's still room for removing misgivings and persuading all sides to come to the negotiating table.
Pakistan's nuclear arsenal, believed to be the world's fastest growing, is also expected to come under discussion in Sharif's meeting with President Obama. But Pakistani officials have rejected media reports as unfounded that the two leaders might discuss or conclude a deal that would place curbs on Pakistan's nuclear program in exchange for Islamabad to become a member of the 48-nation nuclear suppliers group, which controls trade and exports of nuclear material. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. A down-on-his-luck rock music manager finds himself stranded in Afghanistan. But there he discovers a young woman who could change his whole life. International Edition's David Byrd has this look at Rock the Casbah, which stars comedian Bill Murray, Kate Hudson, Bruce Willis, and Liam Lubiny.
Richie Lanz has seen better days during his career in rock and roll. Lanz, played by comedic veteran Bill Murray, takes his last client and assistant Ronnie, played by Zooey Deschanel, to Afghanistan to perform for the troops there.
You will play in front of 2,000 horny soldiers.
I'm gonna hurl. Oh my God.
I'm sorry, but I can't tell if you're vomiting or laughing.
When Richie finds himself dumped and stranded in Kabul, he discovers Salima Khan, a Pashtun girl with a beautiful voice who wants to be the first woman to compete in Afghanistan's version of American Idol. At the film's premiere in New York, Bill Murray said that he felt this movie was something special, even as they filmed it.
I haven't felt this way in a long time, that something unusual was happening, that we were really jumping over what was written and what was expected, making something much better than what we walked into at 6 o'clock in the morning and walking out of the every day going, I don't know. And it started with, hey, you know, this might be good. Hey, you know what? This could be really good. And then it was, I think we really got something. I think that's what we have.
As Murray's character navigates Afghanistan, the film also gives audiences a look at some of the consequences of the war there.
What the hell am I doing here?
Richie Lands, talent manager. How y'all doing, guys?
Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Back at you, babe.
Bill Murray says that the film used comedy as a way of getting into the deeper subjects, and it was a challenge to maintain the comedic element when dealing with more serious subject matter.
So that's something that we thought we could get away with, and not get away with, but succeed at. And then the idea of making the story right was going to be determined by the people about whom we were speaking, people from both Afghanistan and the Muslim world. And those people seem to think that not only is it very successful on a human level, that it's respectful, but that it's entertaining, too.
Rock the Casbah director Barry Levinson says that he prefers to use comedy to address tough subjects because that is what real life is like.
I think that sometimes, you know, behavior and real kind of humanistic behavior has a tendency to have humor mixed in with its more dramatic moments, as opposed to saying, well, this is supposed to be dramatic and therefore it's important, or this is a full-out comedy, that the blending of it, it tells you more about human behavior, for me personally.
Actress Leem Lubani, best known for her Oscar-nominated role in 2014's Omar, plays Salima, who dreams of singing on television. She says that the film ultimately is about shared humanity.
Well, for me, I think, although it's like a comedy, but it basically shows two human beings from a completely different, you know, world come together, put hand in hand, and help each other achieve what they want, which is, you know, I think it's such a humanistic story in a way that I think Barry was pretty genius to do that.
Rock the Casbah is rated R for language, including sexual references, some drug use, and brief violence. The movie opens in U.S. theaters October 23rd. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And that's our show. Please check out our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A little more than 4 years ago, the first ripples of unrest in Tunisia signaled an end to the despotic regime of Zine El Abidine Ben Ali and a shift toward democratization of Tunisian society. But what the Tunisian people inherited from the previous regime was a state apparatus crippled by hollowed-out institutions, rife with corruption, and security forces meant to protect the status quo to the detriment of the people. Nonetheless, despite numerous challenges, including an increasing rift between political movements, sporadic civil unrest, and increasing violence, Tunisia slowly and steadily progressed toward democracy. It dismantled the police state, forced opposing political parties to make compromises, held two open and free elections, and last year adopted a progressive constitution. Much of this progress can be credited to Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet, a group of four organizations: the Tunisian General Labor Union, the Tunisian Confederation of Industry, Trade, and Handicrafts, the Tunisian Human Rights League, and the Tunisian Order of Lawyers. The group helped stabilize the fracturing country by drafting an agreement of compromises that served as a roadmap to negotiations and insisting that all parties who wanted to participate in political negotiations must sign the document. 21 parties signed the document, allowing a national dialogue to commence. The Tunisian model of inclusivity and respecting fundamental freedoms of all its citizens is the best answer to the violence and extremist ideologies that have torn apart other countries in the region, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. For its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia, the National Dialogue Quartet won the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize. The United States congratulates Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet on this well-deserved award. This extraordinary honor recognizes the critical role civil society organizations played following the Tunisian Revolution. by preserving national unity and constructing a political process that led to both the Constitution and free and fair national elections, said Secretary of State Kerry. Their inspiring achievement is a shining example for all societies that are working toward an inclusive transition from dictatorship to democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.